the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
In the introduction to her book, The Meaning is in the Waiting, Paula Gooder, who is actually the present Chancellor of St. Paul's Cathedral, writes this. I want you to imagine this. Imagine entering a room, finding a beautifully wrapped present on a table. Attached to the present is a label that reads, "This present is for you, but don't open it now. Wait." This is what Gooder goes on to say in her writing. She says, "Waiting isn't something that comes easily to us. It's increasingly a strange notion. We have become accustomed to immediacy and to swift action." And I think that's true. And yet, as we start this season of Advent, as we approach Christmas, this is what we're being encouraged to do. We're being encouraged to wait. We're being encouraged to anticipate the coming of Jesus. We're being encouraged to prepare our hearts to receive God's gift, the gift of his Son. And the word Advent comes from the Latin word adventus, which simply translates as coming. So this isn't a passive word. It's not passive, it's not still, it's a word that describes an action. So God is at work, God is on the move. The King is coming, and we're called to be ready for his arrival. So over the four Sundays of Advent, we're going to look afresh at some of the familiar stories, all recorded by the two gospel writers, Luke and Matthew. And these are stories that we know really, really well. We've heard them. We've heard them again and again and again since childhood. And because of that, I think there's a danger, of course, that we think we know them inside out. We know absolutely everything about the Christmas story. But if we think like that, I think we will fail to allow them to speak to us in new ways. But my prayer is that all of us, myself included, of course, is that we choose this month to stop, to wait, to allow God through his Spirit to open our eyes. My prayer is that we'll just get fresh glimpses of the wonder of what God has done for us in sending his Son into this world. Now, traditionally, the four Sundays before Christmas are all given a theme each. It came, if you noticed, in the chorus of the song that we sung just now. And it's a pattern that we're going to follow as we think about hope and joy and love and peace. And this year we're going to add to the traditional list. We're going to consider the theme of wonder in the Sunday immediately after Christmas especially. And on each of those Sundays, we're going to retrace the events through the eyes of particular characters within the Christmas narrative. It's very fitting, isn't it? It's almost like it's planned that on Baptism Sunday, we should be thinking about Zechariah and Elizabeth, the parents of John the Baptist. Now, my intention this morning, you'll be pleased to know, is that I'm going to keep it quite brief. And immediately after I finish speaking, there's going to be a short video to wrap up our thoughts. And then we're going to respond. We're going to respond by standing and singing and worshiping and praising God together. Now, if you've got your Bibles open, this is where we're going to be going. This will help us to just orientate ourselves across the passage. We're thinking of hope. We're going to do it in three straightforward headings. Hope looks back, hope looks up, hope looks forward. So here we go. Here's the first one. Hope looks back. So Luke opens his gospel record. If you know Luke chapter 1, there's two big announcements. There's two baby birth announcements here. Two babies are going to be born. One to a couple in advancing years, who've been married for a long time. That's Zechariah and Elizabeth that we've read about. And the other is a young engaged couple, Mary and Joseph. And these couples, so we discover later in the chapter, are related because Mary and Elizabeth are cousins. We read verse 5, Zechariah and Elizabeth, they come from the tribe of Levi. Now, that is the tribe from which all the people are drawn from who serve in different ways within the worshipping life of the nation. This is where the priests came from. Men who usually juggled a couple of roles. Oftentimes, they were local community leaders. And secondly, they were part of a group who dedicated themselves to regularly serving in the temple, in the place of worship in Jerusalem. And whilst not all Levites were priests, there were, however, a large number of priests within the tribe. Now, clearly, not all of them could serve at the same time in the temple. It would be the same if every member of the Zion Works and the sound team turned up today and said, "I think it's my turn." That's what it would be like. It would be utter chaos. And so clearly not all of them could serve in the temple at the same time. So they're divided into groups. Zechariah was placed in the priestly list, named after a priest whose story we can read about if you go back into Chronicles, named Abijah. And whilst it's more than likely that Zechariah would serve quite regularly in the temple courts, the chances of him being chosen by lot from a long list of names to take on this most sacred of acts, that of burning the sweet-smelling paste on the altar of incense, was likely to happen once or at best twice within his lifetime. So the words of verses 9 and 10 become particularly poignant, don't they? So it's with this deep sense of reverence and awe, Zechariah accepts this privileged role. He prepares the herbs and the spices for the altar using a recipe that's been handed down from priest to priest over many generations. Interestingly enough, if you want to know the recipe for that, you can find it. Here it is. You can find it in Exodus chapter 30 with this instruction. Take fragrant spices, gum, resin, onigar, and galbanum, and pure frankincense. Interesting that it's frankincense, I'll leave that one with you, all in equal amounts, and make a fragrant blend of incense, the work of a perfumer. It is to be salted and pure and sacred. So alongside this duty, Zechariah would pray to God on behalf of the people. And amongst his prayers would be a set liturgical prayer that was a prayer of hope. And it was a prayer of hope that God would one day send the Messiah. He would one day send his chosen one to bring justice and rescue and order. And it was a particularly important prayer and a pertinent prayer for the time because Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth lived in dark days. The nation was under rule, under the occupancy of Rome. Herod's kingship, as noted in verse 5, was actually merely just a token gesture to the people. His power was curtailed by Rome. He was Caesar's puppet. And added to this political uncertainty, this instability, this occupancy from Rome, added to that, there'd been no prophetic voice for centuries. For 400 years, it appeared that God had been silent. There are 400 years between you moving from the end of the Old Testament and flicking the page and starting in the New Testament. And if you did it chronologically, of course, this would be the first story that you should read, because this is the first one in the story of Christmas. So there's a gap, 400 years. And yet, again, in faithful hope, in trust, Zechariah comes to the temple. He looks back and he prays forward. That's what he does. He looks back and he prays forward. He takes his place amongst those who faithfully serve God in dark times. Now, for Zechariah and Elizabeth, this faithful devotion to God was an ever-present reality. I say that because of their names. Their names are really interesting. Zechariah's name means God has remembered. Interesting given the context of 400 years of silence. And Elizabeth means God is my promise. And yet whilst nationally, personally, as we'll discover, things aren't that great for the couple, Zechariah stands before God, he looks back, and he prays forward. He stands in hope. Isaiah, who was a prophet writing almost 500 years before Zechariah, looked forward to a time when God would come and rescue his people. And this is what he wrote. This was his words of encouragement. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. Wouldn't that be a great prayer, perhaps, for Zechariah to have on his lips as he enters the temple? Wouldn't that be a great prayer for us today? Because we all live in difficult times. And for the people of Israel, the promise of God's Messiah that Zechariah looked back to in hope was a long time coming. The present was on the table. The tag says, "This present is for you, but don't open it yet. Wait." And yet, whilst the wait was a long time coming, God had remembered. God would keep his promise. Let's move on. Hope looks back, hope looks up. Now, if you noticed in the reading, we saw it emphasized several times that Zechariah and Elizabeth's story is one that's not only set within this context of political and national crisis, there is also a personal story, isn't there? A very personal story that runs alongside. They longed for a child. And now it appears, humanly speaking, this was something that was way beyond their grasp. And yet, despite this pain of the realization, we find Zechariah serving faithfully in the temple. Or maybe it's because of that pain that Zechariah serves faithfully in the temple. He's drawn, isn't he, into God's presence time and time again. And so often in the Bible, we read stories that would lead us, I think, towards accepting a reality that tells us we don't really start to appreciate hope without first having experienced grief. You see, hope dares to admit that not everything is as it should be. If we want to be hopeful, first, I think we have to grieve. We have to see that something's broken, because it's through that realization that we then get to rely on the truth of hope. You know, I think that maybe is where we are today as a nation, to be honest. As we head towards an election where all party leaders, of course, would want us to believe that if they were elected, that their policies were realized, that things would be better. We would be a less fractured nation. Yet maybe first of all, we have to come to a place and acknowledge, everyone acknowledge, that there's brokenness and division all around us. We have to acknowledge that our part as well in that grief. And we have to grieve over it. Maybe it's only then that we can dare to hope. Hope for something more, for a fairer society, for a society where we can work together. You know, I think that the message of hope within Advent is partly a reminder that God visits us where we are. That's Zechariah's experience, isn't it, in the story. He comes in the waiting. He comes when we least expect him, when we're going about our every day. Whether that means for Zechariah, he's serving in the temple, or for us, whatever it may mean for us in the remainder of the day or in tomorrow or this week. He comes to us in the waiting. God also comes to us when we doubt. He comes to us when we're broken and when we're hurt. He comes to us when we're sad. He comes to us when we feel isolated. He comes to us when we're alone. He comes into the very mess of our lives. And he whispers, hope. And for Zechariah, God comes in this remarkable way. When he is looking up in hope, he's suddenly aware of an angel standing beside him. And the angel delivers a message. And it's startling, isn't it? This is what he says. "Do not be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has heard." And maybe in that moment, Zechariah says, "Which prayer? Which prayer? The prayer I've just prayed concerning the promised Messiah? Or the prayer that my wife and I have been praying repeatedly year upon year? Which prayer, Gabriel?" And the angel's quick, isn't he, to tell him it's the prayer for the child that's being answered. And yet in reality, of course, both of his prayers have been heard. Both of his prayers are going to be answered. Look again at what it says. "Your wife will bear you a son. You are to call him John. He will be a joy and delight to you, and many will rejoice because of his birth. And then later on, he will make ready a people prepared for the Lord." Now, I hope you'll forgive me. I have an awful lot of sympathy for Zechariah. In this moment, his life is turned upside down. And he has what, in my experience, is quite an instinctive reaction. He asks a question. That's what he does. He says, it's a simple one. He says, how can I be sure of this? Now, my sympathy lies with Zechariah because his question, I think, finds a very direct echo in Mary's words later in the chapter where her reply to the angel's message is, how will this be? Now, of course, the results of asking those questions are very different because Zechariah discovers that because of his question, the resultant action of the angel is that he removes Zechariah's ability to speak and probably to hear as well, since the word used probably means both. But don't, please don't, think of this primarily as a punishment, because I don't think it is. But instead, it's a sign. It is an indicator that God is at work. You see, in fact, it's one of the signs that Jesus seeks to reassure John the Baptist in later life as being evidence that he's the Messiah. This is what he says. When John's followers come to Jesus, Jesus sends them back. He says, report this to John. Go back, report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk. Those who have leprosy are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised. And the good news is proclaimed to the poor. It's a sign of God's kingdom on the move. It's a sign, if you like, of Adventus. The king is coming, Zechariah. Not quite yet. And guess what? You don't get to tell the news. Not quite yet. But when I tell you, you can. Hope looks forward. And with this, we'll finish. Can you imagine the scene? Zechariah, eventually after some time, it's obviously a little bit longer than was expected by the people, he leaves the temple, he goes out, he rejoins the people who are waiting in the temple courts. He's unable to offer the parting prayer to the people that would normally have concluded this part of the ceremony of the burning of the incense. And, as verse 23 reminds us, he goes on and concludes what is in fact a week-long duty in the temple. So I don't know whether this is day one or day five or day seven, wherever it may be, but he's still got a week's work possibly to do. And he is unable to tell anybody about what has happened to him. The present is on the table. Zechariah has now glimpsed what is inside the box, but he still can't open it. And he still can't tell anybody about it. God says, wait. And the waiting goes on for what must have seemed like a lifetime to Zechariah, for the rest of the week, for the time he travels home. Imagine knowing what he knew and not being able to speak of it. Can you imagine that Zechariah must have been counting down the days, hoping that every day would be the words that the angel says in verse 20, the appointed time. Maybe it is today. Maybe the appointed time is today. Imagine having the best possible news but being unable to share it. Zechariah looked forward with hope, a hope that would, of course, be strengthened day by day as he watched for the inevitable changes in Elizabeth as the baby grew within her. The waiting was not long coming. Not only for them as a couple, but also, as the story of the Gospels, of course, reveal, for the world. And whilst, as we know, Zechariah's hope looking forward was centered on the birth of his son, our hope looking forward is centered on the birth of God's son. But not simply his birth, because Advent speaks of both his first coming and his second coming. It's that time when, as Paul writes to his friends in Philippi, at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth. Let me leave you with a couple of thoughts to take away before we watch the video and then Johnny leads us in sung praise. If you're here this morning and you don't know where your hope lies, I would invite you to look in the manger and then look at the cross. Because the story of the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus demands a response from each and every one of us. You see, our story is one of rebellion. God's story is one of rescue. Our story is one of hopelessness. God's story is full of hope. Our story is full of brokenness. God's story is a story of peace and unity. Our story is one of desperate need. God's story is one of power. Our story is one of sinfulness. God's story is one of salvation and holiness. And the question is, why not be part of God's story? But if you're here this morning, you know about this hope. You've experienced the love and the joy and the peace and the wonder that it brings. Then why on earth do we act sometimes like we've been struck dumb? Sometimes it seems we do more than simply imagine what it's like to know the best piece of news the world will ever hear and keep it to ourselves. We actually live our lives like it. Let's not be like that at Christmas. The moment Zechariah could tell the news, he spoke it. That's what we read later on in the story. Let's follow his example. Let's speak of the certainty of the hope that we have, centered in Christ. Hope that looks back, that looks up, and looks forward with confidence. Thank you.
I'm pretty sure all of us hope, but all of us differ in what we hope for. My hope for my daughter is that she knows that I love her. I hope that she's happy. I hope that she's healthy. I hope that she flourishes in all the things that she does in her life. I hope that she has friends, true friends. I hope to walk her down the aisle on her wedding day. And yet, what is the greatest hope I have for my daughter? For me, I hope that she knows a love far and beyond anything I could ever give her.